clenched her hips. Lady Glover and the children should not want for wood nor warmth. Put them in some tower, not the dungeons. The babe is sick.
Babes are often sick. Most die and folks are sorry. I shall ask my lord where to put these wolf folk.
She caught the woman's nose between thumb and forefinger and pinched.
You will do as I say, and if this babe dies, no one will be sorrier than you.
Three-Tooth squealed and promised to obey, till Asha let her loose and went to find her uncle. It was good to walk these halls again. 10 Towers had always felt like home to Asha, more so than Pike. Not one castle. 10 castles squashed together, she had thought, the first time she had seen it. She remembered breathless races up and down the steps and along wall walks and covered bridges, fishing off the long stone quay, days and nights lost among her uncle's wealth of books. His grandfather's grandfather had raised the castle, the newest on the isles. Lord Theomore Harlaw had lost 3 sons in the cradle and laid the blame upon the flooded cellars, damp stones, and festering nitre of ancient Harlaw Hall. 10 Towers was airier, more comfortable, better sighted. But Lord Theomore was a changeable man, as any of his wives might have testified. He'd had 6 of those as dissimilar as his 10 towers. The book tower was the fattest of the 10, octagonal in shape and made with great blocks of hewn stone. The stair was built within the thickness of the walls. Asha climbed quickly to the 5th story and the room where her uncle read. Not that there are any rooms where he does not read. Lord Roderick was seldom seen without a book in hand, be it in the privy, on the deck of his sea-song, or whilst holding audience. Asha had oft seen him reading on his high seat beneath the silver scythes. He would listen to each case as it was laid before him, pronounce his judgment, and read a bit, whilst his captain of guards went to bring in the next supplicant. She found him hunched over a table by a window, surrounded by parchment scrolls that might have come from Valyria before its doom, and heavy leather-bound books with bronze and iron hasps. Beeswax candles as thick and tall as a man's arm burned on either side of where he sat, on ornate iron holders. Lord Roderick Harlaw was neither fat nor slim, neither tall nor short, neither ugly nor handsome. His hair was brown, as were his eyes, though the short, neat beard he favoured had gone grey. All in all, he was an ordinary man, distinguished only by his love of written words, which so many iron-born found unmanly and perverse. "Nuncle!" She closed the door behind her. "What reading was so urgent that you leave your guests without a host?"
"Archmaester Marwyn's Book of Lost Books."
He lifted his gaze from the page to study her.
"Hotho brought me a copy from Oldtown. He has a daughter he would have me wed."
Lord Roderick tapped the book with a long nail.
"See here, Marwyn claims to have found 3 pages of signs and portents, visions written down by the maiden daughter of Aenar Targaryen before the doom came to Valyria. Does Lanny know that you are here?"
"Not as yet." Lanny was his pet name for her mother. Only the reader called her that. "Let her rest." Asha moved a stack of books off a stool and seated herself.
"Three-Tooth seems to have lost 2 more of her teeth. Do you call her One-Tooth now?"
"I seldom call her at all. The woman frightens me. What hour is it?"
Lord Roderick glanced out the window at the moonlit sea.
"Dark so soon. I had not noticed. You come late. We looked for you some days ago."
"The winds were against us, and I had captives to concern me. Robet Glover's wife and children. The youngest is still at the breast, and Lady Glover's milk dried up during our crossing. I had no choice but to beach Blackwind upon the stony shore and send my men out to find a wet nurse. They found a goat instead. The girl does not thrive. Is there a nursing mother in the village? Deepwood is important to my plans."
"Your plans must change. You come too late."
"Late and hungry." She stretched her long legs out beneath the table and turned the pages of the nearest book, a Septon's discourse on Major the Cruel's war against the poor fellows.
"Oh, and thirsty, too. A horn of ale would go down well, Nuncle."
Lord Roderick pursed his lips. You know I do not permit food and a drink in my library. The books might suffer harm. Asher laughed. Her uncle frowned. You do like to provoke me. Oh, don't look so aggrieved. I have never met a man I didn't provoke. You should know that well enough by now. But enough of me. You are well? He shrugged. Well enough. My eyes grow weaker. I have sent to Mir for a lens to help me read. And how fares my aunt? Lord Roderick sighed. Still 7 years my elder and convinced 10 towers should be hers. Gwyneth grows forgetful, but that she does not forget. She mourns for her dead husband as deeply as she did the day he died, though she cannot always recall his name. I am not certain she ever knew his name. Asher closed the Septon's book with a thump. Was my father murdered? So your mother believes. There were times when she would gladly have murdered him herself, she thought. And what does my nuncle believe? Balon fell to his death when a rope bridge broke beneath him. A storm was rising and the bridge was swaying and twisting with each gust of wind. Roderick shrugged. Or so we are told. Your mother had a bird from Maester Wendemere. Asher slid her dirk out of its sheath and began to clean the dirt from beneath her fingernails. 3 years away, and the crow's eye returns the very day my father dies. The day after, we had heard. Silence was still out to sea when Balon died, or so it is claimed. Even so, I will agree that Euron's return was timely, shall we say. That is not how I would say it. Asher slammed the point of the dirk into the table. Where are my ships? I counted 20 longships moored below, not near enough to throw the crow's eye off my father's chair. I sent the summons, in your name, for the love I bear you and your mother. House Harlaw has gathered, Stonetree as well, and Volmark, some Mears, all from the Isle of Harlaw, one isle out of 7. I saw one lonely Botley banner in the hall from Pike. Where are the ships from Saltcliff, from Orkwood, from the Wicks? Balor Blacktide came from Blacktide to consult with me, and just as soon set sail again. Lord Roderick closed the book of lost books. He is on Old Wick by now. Old Wick? Asher had feared he was about to say that they had all gone to Pike to do homage to the Crow's Eye. Why Old Wick? I thought you would have heard. Aeron Damphair has called a king's moot. Asha threw back her head and laughed. The drowned god must have shoved a prickle fish up Uncle Aeron's ass. A king's moot? Is this some jape, or does he mean it, truly? The Damphair is not japed since he was drowned, and the other priests have taken up the call. Blind Baron Blacktide, Tarl the thrice drowned, even the old grey gull has left that rock he lives on to preach this king's moot all across Harlaw. The captains are gathering on Old Wick as we speak. Asher was astonished. Has the Crow's Eye agreed to attend this holy farce and abide by its decision? The Crow's Eye does not confide in me. Since he summoned me to Pike to do him homage, I have had no word from Euron. A king's moot. This is something new, or rather something very old. And my uncle Victarion, what does he make of the Damphair's notion? Victarion was sent word of your father's death, and of this king's moot, too, I do not doubt. Beyond that, I cannot say. Better a king's moot than a war. I believe I'll kiss the Damphair's smelly feet and pluck the seaweed from out between his toes. Asher wrenched loose her dirk and sheathed it once again. A bloody king's moot! On Old Wick, confirmed Lord Roderick, though I pray it is not bloody. I have been consulting Hareg's History of the Ironborn. When last the Salt Kings and the Rock Kings met in Kingsmoot, Uron of Orkmont let his axemen loose among them, and Naga's ribs turned red with gore. House Greyiron ruled unchosen for 1,000 years from that dark day until the Andals came. You must lend me Hareg's book, Nuncle. She would need to learn all she could of Kingsmoots before she reached Old Wick. You may read it here. It is old and fragile. He studied her, frowning. Archmaester Rigney once wrote that history is a wheel
for the nature of man is fundamentally unchanging. What has happened before will perforce happen again, he said. I think of that whenever I contemplate the crow's eye. Euron Greyjoy sounds queerly like Euron Greyiron to these old ears. I shall not go to Old Wick. Nor should you. Asha smiled, and missed the first Kingsmoot called in. How long has it been, Nuncle? 4,000 years, if Herreg can be believed. Half that, if you accept Maester Denniston's arguments in questions. Going to Old Wick serves no purpose. This dream of kingship is a madness in our blood. I told your father so the first time he rose, and it is more true now than it was then. It's land we need, not crowns. With Stannis Baratheon and Tywin Lannister contending for the Iron Throne, we have a rare chance to improve our lot. Let us take one side or the other, help them to victory with our fleets, and claim the lands we need from a grateful king. That might be worth some thought, once I sit the sea stone chair, said Asha. Her uncle sighed. You will not want to hear this, Asha, but you will not be chosen. No woman has ever ruled the Ironborn. Gwynnes is 7 years my elder, but when our father died, the Ten Towers came to me. It will be the same for you. You are Balon's daughter, not his son, and you have 3 uncles. 4. 3 Kraken uncles. I do not count. You do with me. So long as I have my Nuncle of 10 Towers, I have Harlow. Harlow was not the largest of the Iron Islands, but it was the richest and most populous, and Lord Roderick's power was not to be despised. On Harlow, Harlow had no rival. The Volmarks and Stone Trees had large holdings on the isle and boasted famous captains and fierce warriors of their own, but even the fiercest bent beneath the scythe. The Kennings and the Mears, once bitter foes, had long ago been beaten down to vassals. My cousins do me fealty, and in war I should command their swords and sails. In Kingsmoot, though? Lord Roderick shook his head. Beneath the bones of Naga, every captain stands as equal. Some may shout your name, I do not doubt it, but not enough. And when the shouts ring out for Victarion or the Crow's Eye, some of those now drinking in my hall will join the rest. I say again, do not sail into this storm. Your fight is hopeless. No fight is hopeless till it has been fought. I have the best claim. I am the heir of Balon's body. You are still a willful child. Think of your poor mother. You are all that Lanny has left to her. I will put a torch to Blackwind if need be to keep you here. What, and make me swim to Old Wick? A long, cold swim for a crown you cannot keep. Your father had more courage than sense. The old way served the Isles well when we were one small kingdom amongst many, but Aegon's conquest put an end to that. Balon refused to see what was plain before him. The old way died with Black Harren and his sons. I know that. Asha had loved her father, but she did not delude herself. Balon had been blind in some respects. A brave man, but a bad lord. Does that mean we must live and die as thralls to the Iron Throne? If there are rocks to starboard and a storm to port, a wise captain steers a third course. Show me this third course. I shall, at my queen's moot. Nuncle, how can you even think of not attending? This will be history alive. I prefer my history dead. Dead history is written ink, the living sort in blood. Do you want to die old and craven in your bed? How else? Though not till I'm done reading. Lord Roderick went to the window. You have not asked me about your lady mother. I was afraid. How is she? Stronger. She may yet outlive us all. She will certainly outlive you if you persist in this folly. She eats more than she did when she first came here, and oft sleeps through the night. Good. In her final years on Pike, Lady Alanis could not sleep. She would wander the halls at night with a candle looking for her sons. Maron! She would call shrilly. Roderick, where are you? Theon, my baby, come to mother! Many a time Asha had watched the maester draw splinters from her mother's heels of a morning, after she had crossed the swaying plank bridge to the sea tower on bare feet. I will see her in the morning. She will ask for word of Theon, the Prince of Winterfell. What have you told her?
Little and less. There was naught to tell.
He hesitated.
You are certain that he is dead?
I am certain of nothing.
You found a body.
We found parts of many bodies. The wolves were there before us, the four-legged sort, but they showed scant reverence for their two-legged kin. The bones of the slain were scattered, cracked open for their marrow. I confess it was hard to know what happened there. It seemed as though the Northmen fought among themselves.
Crows will fight over a dead man's flesh and kill each other for his eyes. Lord Roderick stared across the sea, watching the play of moonlight on the waves. We had one king, then five. Now all I see are crows squabbling over the corpse of Westeros.
He fastened the shutters.
Do not go to Old Wick, Asha. Stay with your mother. We shall not have her long, I fear.
Asha shifted in her seat. My mother raised me to be bold. If I do not go, I will spend the rest of my life wondering what might have happened if I had.
If you do go, the rest of your life may be too short for wondering.
Better that than fill the remainder of my days complaining that the sea stone chair by rights was mine. I am no Gwynes.
That made him wince. Asha, my two tall sons fed the crabs of Fair Isle. I am not like to wed again. Stay, and I shall name you heir to the Ten Towers. Be content with that.
Ten Towers?
Would that I could.
Your cousins will not like that.
The knight, old Siegfried, Otho Humpback, they have lands and seats of their own.
True enough. Damp, decaying Harlaw Hall belonged to old Siegfried Harlaw the Silverhair. Humpbacked Hotho Harlaw had his seat at the Tower of Glimmering, on a crag above the western coast. The knight, Sir Harris Harlaw, kept court at Grey Garden. Bodamund the Blue ruled atop Harridan Hill. But each was subject to Lord Roderick. Bodamund has three sons. Siegfried Silverhair has grandsons, and Hotho has ambitions, Asher said. They all mean to follow you, even Siegfried. That one intends to live forever.
The knight will be the Lord of Harlaw after me, her uncle said. But he can rule from Grey Garden as easily as from here. Do fealty to him for the castle, and Sir Harris will protect you.
I can protect myself. Nuncle, I am a Kraken, Usher of House Greyjoy. She pushed to her feet. It's my father's seat I want, not yours. Those scythes of yours look perilous. One could fall and slice my head off.
No,
I'll sit the sea stone chair.
Then you are just another crow screaming for carrion.
Roderick sat again behind his table.
Go. I wish to return to Archmaester Marwyn and his search.
Let me know if he should find another page.
Her uncle was her uncle. He would never change. But he will come to Old Wick, no matter what he says.
By now her crew would be eating in the hall. Asha knew she ought to join them to speak of this gathering on Old Wick and what it meant for them. Her own men would be solidly behind her, but she would need the rest as well, her Harlaw cousins, the Volmarks and the Stone Trees. Those are the ones I must win. Her victory at Deepwood Mott would serve her in good stead once her men began to boast of it, as she knew they would. The crew of the Black Wind took a perverse pride in the deeds of their woman captain. Half of them loved her like a daughter, and the other half wanted to spread her legs, but either sort would die for her.
And I for them, she was thinking, as she shouldered through the door at the bottom of the steps into the moonlit yard.
Asha? A shadow stepped out from behind the well. Her hand went to her dirk at once, until the moonlight transformed the dark shape into a man in a sealskin cloak.
Another ghost.
Triss, I'd thought to find you in the hall.
I wanted to see you.
What part of me, I wonder? She grinned. Well, here I stand, all grown up. Look all you like.
A woman.
He moved closer. and beautiful. Christopher Botley had filled out since last she'd seen him, but he had had the same unruly hair that she remembered, and eyes as large and trusting as a seal's. Sweet eyes, truly. That was the trouble with poor Christopher. He was too sweet for the Iron Islands. His face has grown comely, she thought. As a boy, Triss had been much troubled by pimples. Asha had suffered the same affliction. Perhaps that had been what drew them together.
I was sorry to hear about your father, she told him. I grieve for yours.
Why? Asha almost asked. It was Balon who'd sent the boy away from Pike to be a ward of Baelor Blacktide. Is it true you are Lord Botley now?
In name, at least.
Harren died at Moat Cailin. One of the bog devils shot him with a poisoned arrow. But I am the Lord of Nothing. When my father denied his claim to the sea stone chair, the crow's eye drowned him and made my uncle swear him fealty. Even after that, he gave half my father's lands to Iron Holt. Lord Winch was the first man to bend his knee and call him king. House Winch was strong on Pike, but Asha took care not to let her dismay show. Winch never had your father's courage.
Your uncle bought him, Triss said. The silence returned with holds full of treasure.
Plate and pearls, emeralds and rubies, sapphires big as eggs, bags of coins so heavy that no man can lift them. The crow's eye has been buying friends at every hand. My uncle Germund calls himself Lord Botley now and rules in Lordsport as your uncle's man.
You are the rightful Lord Botley, she assured him. Once I hold the sea stone chair, your father's lands shall be restored.
If you like, it's naught to me.
You look so lovely in the moonlight, Asha. A woman grown now, but I remember when you were a skinny girl with a face all full of pimples. Why must they always mention the pimples?
I remember that as well, though not as fondly as you do. Of the five boys her mother had brought to Pike to foster after Ned Stark had taken her last living son as hostage, Triss had been closest to Asha in age. He had not been the first boy she had ever kissed, but he was the first to undo the laces of her jerkin and slip a sweaty hand beneath to feel her budding breasts. I would have let him feel more than that if he'd been bold enough. Her first flowering had come upon her during the war and wakened her desire, but even before that Asha had been curious. He was there. He was mine own age, and he was willing. That was all it was, that and the moon blood. Even so, she'd called it love, till Triss began to go on about the children she would bear him, a dozen sons at least, and, oh, some daughters too. I don't want to have a dozen sons, she had told him, appalled. I want to have adventures. Not long after, Maester Cailin found them at their play, and young Christopher Botley was sent away to Blacktide. I wrote you letters, he said, but Maester Josserin would not send them. Once I gave a stag to an oarsman on a trader bound for Lordsport, who promised to put my letter in your hands. Your oarsman winkled you and threw your letter in the sea. I feared as much. They never gave me your letters either. I wrote none. In truth, she had been relieved when Triss was sent away. By then his fumblings had begun to bore her. That was not something he would care to hear, however. Aeron Dampair has called a king's moot. Will you come and speak for me?
I will go anywhere with you, but Lord Blacktide says this king's moot is a dangerous folly. He thinks your uncle will descend on them and kill them all, as Uron did.
He's mad enough.
He lacks the strength.
You do not know his strength. He's been gathering men on Pike. Orkward of Orkmont brought him 20 longships, and Pinchface John Meir a dozen. Left-hand Lucas Cod is with them, and Harren Halfhaw, the Red Oarsman, Kemet Pike, the Bastard, Roderick Freeborn, Torwald Browntooth. Men of small account. Asha knew them, every one. The sons of Saltwives, the grandsons of Thralls, the Cods. Do you know their words?
Though all men do despise us, Triss said, but if they catch you in those nets of theirs, you'll be as dead as if they had been dragon lords, and there's worse.
The crow's eye brought back monsters from the east, aye, and wizards, too.
Nuncle always had a fondness for freaks and fools, said Asha. My father used to fight with him about it. Let the wizards call upon their gods. The damp hair will call on ours and drown them. Will I have your voice at the Queen's moot, Triss? You shall have all of me. I am your man forever, Asha. I would wed you. Your lady mother has given her consent. She stifled a groan. You might have asked me first, though you might not have liked the answer half so well. I am no second son now, he went on. I am the rightful Lord Botley, as you said yourself, and you are what I am. Will be settled on Old Wick. Triss, we are no longer children fumbling at each other and trying to see what fits where. You think you want to wed me, but you don't. I do. All I dream about is you. Asha, I swear upon the bones of Naga, I have never touched another woman. Go touch one, or two, or ten. I have touched more men than I can count. Some with my lips, more with my axe. She had surrendered her virtue at 6 and 10 to a beautiful blonde-haired sailor on a trading galley up from Lice. He only knew 6 words of the common tongue, but fuck was one of them, the very word she'd hoped to hear. Afterward, Asha had the sense to find a woods witch who showed her how to brew moon tea to keep her belly flat. Botley blinked as if he did not quite understand what she had said.
I thought you would wait. Why?
He rubbed his mouth. Asha, were you forced? So forced, I tore his tunic. You do not want to wed me. Take my word on that. You are a sweet boy and always were. But I am no sweet girl. If we wed soon enough, you'd come to hate me. Never. Asha, I have ached for you. She had heard enough of this. A sickly mother, a murdered father, and a plague of uncles were enough for any woman to contend with. She did not require a love-sick puppy, too. Find a brothel, Triss. They'll cure you of that ache. I could never. Christopher shook his head. You and I were meant to be, Asha. I have always known you would be my wife and the mother of my sons. He seized her upper arm. In a blink, her dirk was at his throat. Take your hand away or you won't live long enough to breed a son. Now! When he did, she lowered the blade. You want a woman? Well and good. I'll put one in your bed tonight. Pretend she's me, if that will give you pleasure. But do not presume to grab at me again. I am your queen, not your wife. Remember that. Asha sheathed her dirk and left him standing there with a fat drop of blood slowly creeping down his neck, black in the pale light of the moon.
It was almost dawn before the rain let up enough for the combat to take place. The castle yard was a morass of soft mud, glistening wetly by the light of 100 torches. Beyond the field, a gray mist was rising, sending ghostly fingers up the pale stone walls to grasp the castle battlements. Many of the wedding guests had vanished during the intervening hours, but those who remained climbed the viewing stand again and settled themselves on planks of rain-soaked pine. Amongst them stood Ser Gorman Peak, surrounded by a knot of lesser lords and household knights. It had been only a few years since Dunk had squired for old Ser Arlen. He had not forgotten how. He cinched the buckles on Ser Glendon's ill-fitting armor, fastened his helm to his gorget, helped him mount, and handed him his shield. Earlier contests had left deep gouges in the wood, but the blazing fireball could still be seen. He looks as young as Egg, Dunk thought, a frightened boy and grim. His sorrel mare was unbarded and skittish as well. He should have stayed with his own mount. The sorrel may be better bred and swifter, but a rider rides best on a horse that he knows well, and this one is a stranger to him. I'll need a lance, Ser Glendon said. A war lance. Dunk went to the racks. War lances were shorter and heavier than the tourney lances that had been used in all the earlier tilts. 8 feet of solid ash, ending in an iron point. Dunk chose one and pulled it out, running his hand along its length to make sure it had no cracks. At the far end of the lists, one of Damon's squires was offering him a matching lance. He was a fiddler no more. In place of swords and fiddles, the trapping of his warhorse now displayed the three-headed dragon of House Blackfyre, black on a field of red. The prince had washed the black dye from his hair as well, so it flowed down to his collar in a cascade of silver and gold that glimmered like beaten metal in the torchlight. Egg would have hair like that if he ever let it grow, Dunk realized. He found it hard to picture him that way, but one day he knew he must, if the two of them should live so long. The herald climbed his platform once again. "Sir Glendon the Bastard stands accused of theft and murder," he proclaimed, "and now comes forth to prove his innocence at the hazard of his body. Damon of House Blackfyre, the second of his name, right-born king of the Andals and the Roimar and the First Men, lord of the Seven Kingdoms and protector of the realm, comes forth to prove the truth of the accusations against the bastard Glendon." And all at once the years fell away, and Dunk was back at Ashford Meadow once again, listening to Baelor Breakspear just before they went forth to battle for his life. He slipped the war lance back in place, plucked a tourney lance from the next rack, 12 feet long, slender, elegant. "Use this," he told Sir Glendon. "It's what we used at Ashford at the Trial of Seven. The fiddler chose a war lance. He means to kill me." "First he has to strike you. If your aim is true, his point will never touch you." "I don't know." "I do." Sir Glendon snatched the lance from him, wheeled about, and trotted toward the lists. "Seven save us both, then." Somewhere in the east, lightning cracked across a pale pink sky. Damon raked his stallion's side with golden spurs and leapt forward like a thunderclap, lowering his war lance with its deadly iron point. Sir Glendon raised his shield and raced to meet him, swinging his own longer lance across his mare's head to bear upon the young pretender's chest. Mud sprayed back from their horses' hooves, and the torches seemed to burn the brighter as the two knights went pounding past. Dunk closed his eyes. He heard a crack, a shout, a thump. "No!" he heard Lord Peak cry out in anguish. "No!" For half a heartbeat, Dunk almost felt sorry for him. He opened his eyes again. Riderless, the big black stallion was slowing to a trot. Dunk jumped out and grabbed him by the reins. At the far end of the lists, Sir Glendon Ball wheeled his mare and raised his splintered lance. Men rushed onto the field to where the fiddler lay unmoving, face down in a puddle. When they helped him to his feet, he was mud from head to heel. "The brown dragon!" someone shouted. Laughter rippled through the yard as the dawn washed over White Walls. It was only a few heartbeats later, as Dunk and Sir Kyle were helping Glendon Ball off his horse, that the first trumpet blew, and the sentries on the walls raised the alarum. An army had appeared outside the castle, rising from the morning mists. "Egg wasn't lying after all," Dunk told Sir Kyle, astonished. From Maidenpool had come Lord Mouton. From Raventree, Lord Blackwood. From Duskendale, Lord Darklin. The royal domains about King's Landing sent forth Hayfords, Rossbys, Stokeworths, Masseys, and the king's own sworn swords, led by 3 knights of the Kingsguard and stiffened by 300 raven's teeth with tall white weirwood bows. Mad Danielle Lothston herself rode forth in strength from her haunted towers at Harrenhal, clad in black armor that fit her like an iron glove, her long red hair streaming. The light of the rising sun glittered off the points of 500 lances and 10 times as many spears. The knight's gray banners were reborn in 50 gaudy colors, and above them all flew 2 regal dragons on night-black fields, the great 3-headed beast of King Ares I, Targaryen, red as fire, and a white-winged fury breathing scarlet flame. Not Makar, after all, Dunk knew when he saw those banners. The banners of the Prince of Summerhall showed 4 3-headed dragons, 2 and 2, the arms of the fourth-born son of the late King Daeron II, Targaryen. A single white dragon announced the presence of the King's Hand, Lord Brynden Rivers. Bloodraven himself had come to White Walls. The first Blackfyre Rebellion had perished on the Redgrass Field in blood and glory. The second Blackfyre Rebellion ended with a whimper. "They cannot cow us!" young Daemon proclaimed from the castle battlements after he had seen the ring of iron that encircled them. "For our cause is just! We'll slash through them and ride hell-bent for King's Landing! Sound the trumpets!" Instead, knights and lords and men-at-arms muttered quietly to one another, and a few began to slink away, making for the stables or a postern gate or some hidey-hole they hoped might keep them safe. And when Daemon drew his sword and raised it above his head, every man of them could see it was not Blackfyre. "We'll make another Redgrass Field today," the pretender promised. "Piss on that fiddle, boy," a grizzled squire shouted back at him. "I'd sooner live." In the end, the second Daemon Blackfyre rode forth alone, reined up before the royal host, and challenged Lord Bloodraven to single combat. "I will fight you, or the coward Ares, or any champion you care to name." Instead, Lord Bloodraven's men surrounded him, pulled him off his horse, and clasped him into golden fetters. The banner he had carried was planted in the muddy ground and set afire. It burned for a long time, sending up a twisted plume of smoke that could be seen for leagues around. The only blood that was shed that day came when a man in service to Lord Virwell began to boast that he had been one of Bloodraven's eyes and would soon be well rewarded. "By the time the moon turns, I'll be fucking whores and drinking Dornish red," he was purported to have said, just before one of Lord Costain's knights slit his throat. "Drink that," he said as Virwell's man drowned in his own blood. "That's not Dornish, but it's red." Elsewise, it was a sullen, silent column that trudged through the gates of White Walls to toss their weapons into a glittering pile before being bound and led away to await Lord Bloodraven's judgment. Dunk emerged with the rest of them, together with Ser Kyle the Cat and Glendon Ball. They had looked for Ser Maynard to join them, but Plum had melted away sometime during the night. It was late that afternoon before Ser Roland Crakehall of the Kingsguard found Dunk among the other prisoners. "Ser Duncan, where in 7 hells have you been hiding? Lord Rivers has been asking for you for hours. Come with me, if you please." Dunk fell in beside him. Crakehall's long cloak flapped behind him with every gust of wind, as white as moonlight on snow. The sight of it made him think back to the words the fiddler had spoken up on the roof. "I dreamed that you were all in white from head to heel, with a long pale cloak flowing from those broad shoulders." Dunk snorted. "Aye, and you dreamed of dragons hatching from stone eggs. One as likely as to other." The Hand's pavilion was half a mile from the castle, in the shade of a spreading elm tree. A dozen cows were cropping at the grass nearby. "Kings rise and fall," Dunk thought, "and cows and small folk go about their business." It was something the old man used to say. "What will become of all of them?" he asked Ser Roland as they passed a group of captives sitting on the grass. "They'll be marched back to King's Landing for a trial. The knights and men-at-arms should get off light enough. They were only following their liege lords."
"And the lords?"
"Some will be pardoned, so long as they tell the truth of what they know and give up a son or daughter to vouchsafe their future loyalty. It will go harder for those who took pardons after the Redgrass Field. They'll be imprisoned or attainted. The worst will lose their head." Bloodraven had made a start on that already, Dunk saw when they came up on his pavilion. Flanking the entrance, the severed heads of Gorman Peak and Black Tom Heddle had been impaled on spears, with their shields displayed beneath them. Three castles, black on orange, the man who slew Roger of Pennytree. Even in death, Lord Gorman's eyes were hard and flinty. Dunk closed them with his fingers. "What did you do that for?" asked one of the guardsmen. "The crows'll have them soon enough." "I owed him that much. If Roger had not died that day, the old man would never have looked twice at Dunk when he saw him chasing that pig through the alleys of King's Landing. Some old dead king gave a sword to one son instead of another. That was the start of it. And now I'm standing here, and poor Roger's in his grave." "The hand awaits," commanded Roland Crakehall. Dunk stepped past him into the presence of Lord Brynden Rivers, bastard, sorcerer, and hand of the king. Egg stood before him, freshly bathed and garbed in princely raiment, as would befit a nephew of the king. Nearby, Lord Frey was seated in a camp chair with a cup of wine to hand and his hideous little heir squirming in his lap. Lord Butterwell was there as well, on his knees, pale-faced and shaking. "Treason is no less vile because the traitor proves a craven," Lord Rivers was saying. "I have heard your bleatings, Lord Ambrose, and I believe one word in ten. On that account, I will allow you to retain a tenth part of your fortune. You may keep your wife as well. I wish you joy of her." "And White Walls?" asked Butterwell with quavering voice. "Forfeit to the Iron Throne. I mean to pull it down stone by stone and sow the ground that it stands upon with salt. In 20 years, no one will remember it existed. Old fools and young malcontents still make pilgrimages to the red grass field to plant flowers on the spot where Damon Blackfyre fell. I will not suffer White Walls to become another monument to the Black Dragon." He waved a pale hand. "Now scurry away, roach." "The hand is kind." Butterwell stumbled off, so blind with grief that he did not even seem to recognize Dunk as he passed. "You have my leave to go as well, Lord Frey," Rivers commanded. "We will speak again later."
"As my lord commands."
Frey led his son from the pavilion. Only then did the king's hand turn to Dunk. He was older than Dunk remembered him, with a lined, hard face, but his skin was still as pale as bone, and his cheek and neck still bore the ugly wine-stained birthmark that some people thought looked like a raven. His boots were black, his tunic scarlet. Over it he wore a cloak the color of smoke, fastened with a brooch in the shape of an iron hand. His hair fell to his shoulders, long and white and straight, brushed forward so as to conceal his missing eye, the one that Bittersteel had plucked from him on the red grass field. The eye that remained was very red. How many eyes has Bloodraven? 1,000 eyes and 1. No doubt Prince Maekar had some good reason for allowing his son to squire for a hedge knight, he said, though I cannot imagine it included delivering him to a castle full of traitors plotting rebellion. How is it that I come to find my cousin in this nest of adders, sir? Lord Butterbutt would have me believe that Prince Maekar sent you here to sniff out this rebellion in the guise of a mystery knight. Is that the truth of it? Dunk went to one knee. No, my lord. I mean, yes, my lord. That's what Aeg told him. Aegon, I mean, Prince Aegon. So that part's true. It isn't what you'd call the true truth, though. I see. So the two of you learned of this conspiracy against the crown and decided you would thwart it by yourselves. Is that the way of it?
That's not it either. We just sort of blundered into it, I suppose you'd say.
Egg crossed his arms.
And Sir Duncan and I had matters well in hand before you turned up with your army.
We had some help, my lord, Dunk added. Hedge knights. Aye, my lord. Sir Kyle the Cat and Maynard Plum. And Sir Glendon Ball. It was him unhorsed the pretender. Yes, I've heard that tale from 50 lips already. The bastard of the Pussy Willows, born of a whore and a traitor.
Born of heroes, Egg insisted. If he's among the captives, I want him found and released, and rewarded.
And who are you to tell the king's hand what to do?
Egg did not flinch. You know who I am, cousin.
Your squire is insolent, sir, Lord Rivers said to Dunk. You ought to beat that out of him.
I've tried, my lord. He's a prince, though.
What he is, said Bloodraven, is a dragon.
Rise, sir.
Dunk rose. There have always been Targaryens who dreamed of things to come since long before the conquest, Bloodraven said. So we should not be surprised if from time to time a Blackfyre displays the gift as well. Daemon dreamed that a dragon would be born at White Walls, and it was. The fool just got the color wrong.
Dunk looked at Egg. The ring, he saw. His father's ring. It's on his finger, not stuffed up inside his boot.
I have half a mind to take you back to King's Landing with us, Lord Rivers said to Egg, and keep you at my court as my
guest. My father would not take kindly to that.
I suppose not. Prince Maekar has a prickly nature. Perhaps I should send you back to Summerhall.
My place is with Sir Duncan. I'm his squire.
Seven save you both. As you wish, you're free to go.
We will, said Egg, but first we need some gold. Sir Duncan needs to pay the snail his ransom.
Bloodraven laughed. What happened to the modest boy I once met at King's Landing? As you say, my prince, I will instruct my paymaster to give you as much gold as you wish, within reason. Only as a loan, insisted Dunk. I'll pay it back. When you learn to joust, no doubt.
Lord Rivers flicked them away with his fingers, unrolled a parchment, and began to tick off names with a quill.
He is marking down the men to die, Dunk realized. My lord, he said, we saw the heads outside. Is that... Will the fiddler, Daemon, will you have his head as well?
Lord Bloodraven looked up from his parchment.
That is for King Ares to decide. But Daemon has 4 younger brothers and sisters as well. Should I be so foolish as to remove his pretty head, his mother will mourn, his friends will curse me for a kinslayer, and Bittersteel will crown his brother Hagon. Dead, young Daemon is a hero. Alive, he is an obstacle in my half-brother's path. He can hardly make a 3rd Blackfyre king whilst the 2nd remains so inconveniently alive. Besides, such a noble captive will be an ornament to our court, and a living testament to the mercy and benevolence of his grace, King Ares.
I have a question, too, said Egg.
I begin to understand why your father was so willing to be rid of you. What more would you have of me, cousin?
Who took the dragon's egg? There were guards at the door and more guards on the steps. No way anyone could have gotten into Lord Butterwell's bedchamber unobserved.
Lord Rivers smiled. Were I to guess, I'd say someone climbed up inside the privy shaft.
The privy shaft was too small to climb.
For a man, a child could do it.
Or a dwarf, Dunk blurted. 1,000 eyes and one. Why shouldn't some of them belong to a troop of comic dwarfs?
Theon. There was no safe anchorage at Pike, but Theon Greyjoy wished to look on his father's castle from the sea, to see it as he had seen it last, 10 years before, when Robert Baratheon's war galley had borne him away to be a ward of Eddard Stark. On that day, he had stood beside the rail, listening to the stroke of the oars and the pounding of the master's drum, while he watched Pike dwindle in the distance. Now he wanted to see it grow larger, to rise from the sea before him. Obedient to his wishes, the Miraham beat her way past the point, with her sail snapping and her captain cursing the wind and his crew and the follies of high-born lordlings. Theon drew the hood of his cloak up against the spray and looked for home. The shore was all sharp rocks and glowering cliffs, and the castle seemed one with the rest, its towers and walls and bridges quarried from the same grey-black stone, wet by the same salt waves, festooned with the same spreading patches of dark green lichen, speckled by the droppings of the same sea birds. The point of land on which the Greyjoys had raised their fortress had once thrust like a sword into the bowels of the ocean, but the waves had hammered at it day and night until the land broke and shattered thousands of years past. All that remained were three bare and barren islands and a dozen towering stacks of rock that rose from the water like the pillars of some sea god's temple while the angry waves foamed and crashed among them. Drear, dark, forbidding, Pike stood atop those islands and pillars, almost a part of them. Its curtain wall, closing off the headland around the foot of the great stone bridge that leapt from the cliff top to the largest islet, dominated by the massive bulk of the great keep. Farther out were the kitchen keep and the bloody keep, each on its own island. Towers and outbuildings clung to the stacks beyond, linked to each other by covered archways when the pillars stood close, by long, swaying walks of wood and rope when they did not. The sea tower rose from the outmost island at the point of the broken sword, the oldest part of the castle, round and tall, the sheer-sided pillar on which it stood half-eaten through by the endless battering of the waves. The base of the tower was white from centuries of salt spray, the upper stories green from the lichen that crawled over it like a thick blanket, the jagged crown black with soot from its nightly watchfire. Above the sea tower snapped his father's banner. The Miraham was too far off for Theon to see more than the cloth itself, but he knew the device it bore. The gold kraken of House Greyjoy, arms writhing and reaching against a black field. The banner streamed from an iron mast, shivering and twisting as the wind gusted, like a bird struggling to take flight. And here at least the direwolf of Stark did not fly above, casting its shadow down upon the Greyjoy kraken. Theon had never seen a more stirring sight. In the sky behind the castle, the fine red tail of the comet was visible through thin, scuttling clouds. All the way from Riveron to Seagard, the Malisters had argued about its meaning. "It is my comet," Theon told himself, sliding a hand into his fur-lined cloak to touch the oilskin pouch snug in its pocket. Inside was the letter Robb Stark had given him, paper as good as a crown.
"Does a castle look as you remember it, my lord?"
the captain's daughter asked, as she pressed herself against his arm.
"It looks smaller," Theon confessed, "though perhaps that's only the distance."
The Miraham was a fat-bellied southern merchanter up from Oldtown, carrying wine and cloth and seed to trade for iron ore. Her captain was a fat-bellied southern merchanter as well, and the stony sea that foamed at the feet of the castle made his plump lips quiver, so he stayed well out. Farther out than Theon would have liked. An iron-born captain in a long ship would have taken them along the cliffs and under the high bridge that spanned the gap between the gatehouse and the great keep. but this plump old-towner had neither the craft, the crew, nor the courage to attempt such a thing. So they sailed past at a safe distance, and Theon must content himself with seeing Pike from afar. Even so, the Mirraham had to struggle mightily to keep itself off those rocks. "It must be windy there," the captain's daughter observed. He laughed. "Windy and cold and damp. A miserable, hard place, in truth. But my lord father once told me that hard places breed hard men, and hard men rule the world." The captain's face was as green as the sea when he came bowing up to Theon and asked, "May we make for port now, my lord?" "You may," Theon said, a faint smile playing about his lips. The promise of gold had turned the old towner into a shameless lickspittle. It would have been a much different voyage if a longship from the islands had been waiting at sea guard as he'd hoped. Iron-born captains were proud and willful, and did not go in awe of a man's blood. The islands were too small for awe, and a longship smaller still. If every captain was a king aboard his own ship, as was often said, it was small wonder they named the islands the Land of 10,000 Kings. And when you had seen your kings shit over the rail and turn green in a storm, it was hard to bend the knee and pretend they were gods. "The drowned god makes men," old King Euron Redhand had once said thousands of years ago, "but it's men who make crowns." A longship would have made the crossing in half the time as well. The Mirraham was a wallowing tub, if truth be told, and he would not care to be aboard her in a storm. Still, Theon could not be too unhappy. He was here, undrowned, and the voyage had offered certain other amusements. He put an arm around the captain's daughter. "Summon me when we make Lordsport," he told her father. "We'll be below in my cabin." He led the girl away aft, while her father watched them go in sullen silence. The cabin was the captain's, in truth, but it had been turned over to Theon's use when they sailed from Seaguard. The captain's daughter had not been turned over to his use, but she had come to his bed willingly enough all the same. A cup of wine, a few whispers, and there she was. The girl was a shade plump for his taste, with skin as splotchy as oatmeal, but her breast filled his hands nicely, and she had been a maiden the first time he took her. That was surprising at her age, but Theon found it diverting. He did not think the captain approved, and that was amusing as well, watching the man struggle to swallow his outrage while performing his courtesies to the High Lord, the rich purse of gold he'd been promised never far from his thoughts. As Theon shrugged out of his wet cloak, the girl said, "You must be so happy to see your home again, my lord. How many years have you been away?" 10, or close as makes no matter," he told her. "I was a boy of 10 when I was taken to Winterfell as a ward of Eddard Stark." A ward in name, a hostage in truth. Half his day is a hostage, but no longer. His life was his own again, and nowhere a Stark to be seen. He drew the captain's daughter close and kissed her on her ear. "Take off your cloak." She dropped her eyes, suddenly shy, but did as he bid her. When the heavy garment, sodden with spray, fell from her shoulders to the deck, she gave him a little bow and smiled anxiously. She looked rather stupid when she smiled, but he had never required a woman to be clever. "Come here," he told her. She did. "I've never seen the Iron Highlands." "Count yourself fortunate." Theon stroked her hair. It was fine and dark, though the wind had made a tangle of it. "The islands are stern and stony places, scant of comfort and bleak of prospect. Death is never far here, and life is mean and meagre. Men spend their nights drinking ale and arguing over whose lot is worse. The fisher folk who fight the sea, or the farmers who try and scratch a crop from the poor thin soil.
If truth be told, the miners have it worse than either. Breaking their backs down in the dark, and for what? Iron, lead, tin? Those are our treasures. Small wonder the iron men of old turned to raiding. The stupid girl did not seem to be listening.